Join left, right, and center host Bob Scheer for his new podcast, Scheer Intelligence. The twice-monthly podcast features thinkers and trendsetters in conversation with one of political journalism's leading voices. Through the show's unique and sometimes surprising perspectives, you'll get up to speed on the current issues shaping the Beltway and the world. Find Scheer Intelligence on KCRW's iTunes page. From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a
The Department of Justice is investigating the Chicago Police Department, and Donald Trump is calling for a ban on all Muslim entry to the United States. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, correspondent for The Upshot at The New York Times. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Kai Wright, features editor at The Nation magazine. And our special guest is Kelly Goff of The Daily Beast. Welcome to all of you. So Chicago is getting a lot of negative attention. There is a new investigation of the city's police department by the Federal Department of Justice. As you likely have seen, there was this shooting last October by Officer Jason Van Dyke of a black teenager, Laquan McDonald, as he walked away from police officers. Dash cam video from that incident last October was finally released, showing that series of events. And subsequently to that, and of course also subsequently to Rahm Emanuel's re-election as mayor, Officer Van Dyke was charged with murder. There's still evidence missing, including this. There was a Burger King near the shooting that has an 80-minute gap in its surveillance camera footage. The manager of that restaurant says Chicago police deleted that footage, although the police department denies that. Kai, we were talking before the show, and you were saying Rahm has got to go. What do you...
It's plain that, first off, we have to remember it was a very difficult election for Rahm Emanuel, and it is hard to imagine that he would be mayor of Chicago today had this video been released instead of suppressed as it was. And, you know, that's a big deal. That's a big deal. And his legitimacy as a leader is undermined in a time when you have a city that is in deep crisis on a whole lot of levels, but particularly around policing. And he just wouldn't be there. It is an unjust victory. And I have to say, it is also troubling to many, you know, looking at the national level of this, that Hillary Clinton, who has very much positioned herself as a champion of the Black Lives Matter movement and on the side of police reform, has not agreed with has not called for Emanuel to leave. And a lot of folks, at least on the left, were saying, want to hear that from her, and myself included.
So as we look at this from, you know, all over the country, obviously Chicago's the third largest city in the country. It's important in its own right. But I think people are also looking at this and looking at the broader national trends around it and what it means as we think about policing everywhere. And I'd also note, you know, it's hard to understand what good reason there could have been for not releasing this video for so long. But on the other hand, problems with the Chicago Police Department and with race in Chicago go way back before Rahm Emanuel. It's not like we can just sort of blame this on him and say that was the problem. So how should we be thinking about this from outside Chicago?
Well, obviously, I think one of the bigger problems here is when you look, like you said, at Chicago's very challenged history, even more so than some major cities. When you look at Home and Square, the warehouse that made, you know, Gitmo look almost charming. I mean, the fact that people...
Describe that a little bit.
Oh, so Home and Square was the warehouse where defendants would just, people arrested would just disappear for hours. And when I say disappear, I mean their lawyers wouldn't know where they were. Their family wouldn't know where they were. They were often not giving phone calls. I mean, the kind of stuff that, you know, people were complaining about with Guantanamo Bay in terms of potential terror was happening to people being arrested for marijuana possession. I mean, that's what was happening in a major city for years. And so when you look at that and you look at even the fact that they had Illinois did the moratorium on the death penalty because of how problematic some of the evidence gathering techniques had been there for decades, there's a real problem specific to Illinois and Chicago in particular that is, as you said, though, Josh, representative of the larger problems with criminal justice and particularly minorities and poor people's distrust of America's criminal justice system. So I think the fact that you have Rahm Emanuel, who's so closely tied to the Clintons, you know, we all know Bill Clinton's storied history as allegedly the first black president. So to kind of see this evolution, I think it presents a particular problem for Emanuel and possibly for Hillary, because let's be honest, one thing Rahm Emanuel is not a dumb political operative. He's considered one of the most brilliant political operatives that's ever existed. So if anything, the fact that he's known for being too good as a political operative makes it harder to fathom that he was not in the know about some of this information. Am I wrong?
I mean, come on. Rahm was in the dark about everything going on with the police shooting of a black teenager on the eve of his election.
I mean, I'd note, though, not just closely tied to the Clintons, obviously closely tied to Barack Obama, the former chief of staff to President Barack Obama. So, there's a lot of the Democratic Party that this is tied up in.
Which, if anything, would make it so that he would know what was at stake for him in terms of black voters if this information were out, right?
It's worth noting that Bernie Sanders has declared that any elected official who knew about this in advance should resign. Now, you know, there's only one elected official at play here, but...
Rich, as we've been watching stories like this around the country, it seems to me like there's a real tension for conservatives, because on the one hand, conservatives are concerned about law and order and that a decline in respect for the police could lead to an increase in crime, but also conservatives, more than anyone else, sort of point out that when you give government officials unchecked power, they're likely to abuse it. So how do you watch these sorts of cases and figure out how to balance those two sets of concerns?
Well, public officials will lie and cover themselves for all sorts of reasons, and you want to have as much accountability as you have. Video obviously helps a lot, as we see again in this case. A lot of these police unions set up procedures that really tilt the playing field in the direction of police, more so in some cases that are justified. I would just say, in this particular instance, going back to Kai's first point, if it was covered up prior to a highly contested election, the legitimacy of that election is in doubt, which makes it much more serious than just an average garden variety cover-up. I would also say, politically, the lesson from the Tea Party is if you really want to have power and hold over one party, which is the beginning of having influence across the entire country, you have to be able to take down people who are on your own side. And Occupy Wall Street, whether it was never organized enough or just didn't have the desire to do that, didn't do it. And I think this would be a key test of whether Black Lives Matter is willing to do that. And just a big takeaway, Chicago is a corrupt one-party city. I mean, if you're an alderman in Chicago, there's a pretty good chance you're eventually going to jail. The schools are an utter disaster. It is a violent, poorly policed city. I think 2,700 shootings already this year. So this is not a shining example of good government at any level.
Can I just say really quickly, though, as a New Yorker, we can't exactly be too smug about other people's corrupt politics between Shelley Silver, Joe Bruno, and a bunch of others.
No,
I think
no.
So I'm going to own that, because someone in the audience right now is probably tweeting that.
Yeah, no, but I want to push back. Not on the idea that Chicago is corrupt and that various officials there have been bad actors a lot of the time, but just at how much elections matter for this sort of policy stuff. Because, I mean, as I said, like the police in Chicago have been very problematic for a long time. And then also, I mean, when we look at what's happening in Baltimore was sort of one of these prime examples of real black political power in urban cities, and yet seems to have had immense problems of its own with policing. And while nationally the sort of looked for Ferguson effect in a spike of violent crime has not been showing up, we have seen this enormous surge in murders in Baltimore. So it's not clear to me. I think the institutional forces at play in cities are so big that often it doesn't matter that much who wins these elections.
Well, I mean, on the issue of policing, first off, the question is not a diversity question. It's not who the color of the elected officials are, even of the police department. It's the policing system that's been set up, and the really difficult to crack power of the police bureaucracy. It, particularly in large cities, there are large important political players, and it is very difficult for elected officials to go at war with them. And so I think what's relevant in the case of Rahm and how electoral politics play into this, that if you have a local movement that says, Mr. Mayor, unless you stand up to a corrupt police department, you will not be mayor. The stakes are just as high on this end as they are in fighting the police unions and in fighting the police bureaucracy. There is a polarizing effect, and so choose, elected official, which side you're going to be on. This is a fight, and you're not going to be able to avoid a fight. You're going to have to deal with policing. Pick which way you're going to go.
I'm going to push back just a little bit on what Kai said. Most of it I am 100% on board with. But it actually is partially a diversity issue, because one of the things I wrote about last year for the Daily Beast is that when you actually look at major police departments across America, even ones that have racial diversity don't have much background, cultural, or thought diversity in other ways. For instance, most police officers are not college educated. And that sounds like a very small thing, except that police unions' own studies have shown that those who are college educated or have a higher level of education than just high school to some degree have far less complaints against them. And this is not me being a cultural snob. This is what the numbers show for a variety of reasons. For instance, think about the difference between a police officer who's been on a college campus and may have had friends who engaged in things like protests versus one who hasn't. How are those two police officers likely to behave differently if they go to a Black Lives Matter protest, for instance, and are engaging with students who disagree with them? So we have a lot of work to do in this country about changing the image of what a police officer means. And right now, we don't treat the job as something that our best, our brightest, our most engaged, our most culturally savvy go into, and we see the net result.
And that's, while that's true, there is also the fact that the brightest person in the world inside a structure that does not allow them to behave in any way other than a destructive way is going to be destructive. Take, for instance, the New York City Police Department. You are not promoted based on doing
based on doing
positive things. You are promoted based on reaching a certain number of arrests. Those arrests don't even have to be legitimate. It's not that they are convictions. It's not just that it's a hidden quota system mm-hmm. based on something that might actually impact crime. It's a hidden quota system just based on get tickets written. That's it. Not tickets that stand up. And so as long as you have that kind of system, which is defended by a police bureaucracy that has to be broken, then it's difficult for any individuals to do right, and that's a political issue.
Is there anywhere that's doing this well? My sense is sort of that the LAPD has had a significant improvement in its reputation compared to 20-some years ago, in part because it was starting off a really low floor. But
also because I actually did interview the current commissioner's wife about that during their time in LA. And one of the things she talked about is how they were very aggressive the moment they got out there and doing things simply like actually going to Black churches early on, not just to do the smile and wave that a lot of politicians do when they go to Black churches right before Election Day, but to actually build relationships and to say, what are your biggest problems with the LAPD here? Like, where do we start? What are you upset about? What needs are not being serviced here? And keeping the lines of communication open, which actually kind of matters. You know, people treat things like relationships and communications as an afterthought behind ticket quotas and, you know, getting people off the street. You can't do your job effectively as a police department if you don't have relationships and if you don't have a community that trusts you.
And the community policing piece is really important. But there's also a step further, and no police department is doing this, which is shrinking itself. There are too many areas of life that are the responsibility of law enforcement to deal with that are not criminal justice problems. We have too much interaction with individual police officers and with the criminal justice system in general as a solution to things. And that is a core problem. And there's no place that's saying, let's shrink this and find another solution.
I think there's a little bit of that in the way some parole and probation systems have been reforming themselves, with basically changing the metrics on which parole officers are measured, but more broadly changing the idea about what the job of a parole officer is, that being to help people reintegrate into society rather than to find people who are parole violators and put them back in prison. I think that's been a helpful change in perspective, even if it's not a reduction.
But let's not make a mistake. An arrest is a positive event so long as it's of the right person. And it's of a criminal. And it's an enormous benefit to that community if that person is taken off the street, if he or she is genuinely a danger to others.
To the degree that it's an arrest that leads to a conviction because it was a real criminal. The problem is that there is an enormous number of arrests, and the way in which cops are evaluated are not on arresting criminals, they're just on arresting.
Unfortunately, I need to leave it there. Let us know what you think about police reform at kcrw.com/LRC. Up ahead, Donald Trump says don't let any Muslims in. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
Are you thinking about buying a new car? Consider donating your old one to KCRW and support the unique mix of news, music, and culture you love. You'll become a KCRW member and get a nice tax write-off. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow of The New York Times. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Kai Wright of The Nation magazine. And Kelly Goff of The Daily Beast is also with us. So Donald Trump outdid himself this week, calling for, quote, a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States. This was widely condemned by Democrats and many Republicans. Paul Ryan said it's, quote, not who we are as a party. But it sort of is, at least in the sense that pollsters have been finding a fair bit of support about this idea for Republican voters. A new NBC Wall Street Journal poll out on Friday found an even split. 39% of Republicans said they liked Trump's plan. 38% said they didn't. Rich, I feel like immigration has, to this point, been kind of a bright spot for you in evaluating Donald Trump and certainly for National Review.
Well, at least there's one in my evaluation of Donald Trump. Everything else has been wrong.
How are you feeling this week? How did this this idea go down for you?
Oh, it's going great, Josh. It's been a wonderful week.
Oh, good.
Well, look, this proposal goes way too far. It's obviously invidious in its assumption that any Muslim from anywhere and any background is potentially a terror threat. But I do think it's an overreaction, but in part a reaction to the underreaction, where we had someone who is a terrorist operative who just kind of waltzed in on this visa with no one having any idea of her association or her ideology. So if Trump had proposed, say, a pause in non-immigrant visas from Pakistan or Saudi Arabia, would that really have been outrageous? I don't think so. But because it wouldn't have been as outrageous, it wouldn't have served his political interests as well as this one did. And he has proven to have a truly brilliant and reptilian gut-level political instinct for taking a generalized fear about terrorism and a certain level of fear of Muslims and becoming the point of the spear and making that sentiment, giving that sentiment concrete political expression and making it as radical as possible.
I had something close to that in my notes about the overreaction versus underreaction. One thing that I've been seeing a lot is these polls from the Pew Research Center of people in Muslim-majority countries about ISIS. And the finding is most people in Muslim-majority countries dislike ISIS a lot.
Because they're the main people being threatened by ISIS and other terrorists are Muslims.
But here's the thing. Like, in Turkey, it finds 8% of people have a favorable view of ISIS. So, like, most Turks have the right view on this. But 8% of people in Turkey is 6 million people, which is a lot. So I guess the question is, how do we sort of simultaneously deal with both ideas that, like, Islamic extremism mostly hurts other Muslims and is rejected by most Muslims, and at the same time, there is an alarming problem of something like tens of millions of people in the Islamic world who support extremist ideas, and how do we think about dealing with both of those things without ideas like Trump's ridiculous idea gaining currency because it's the one thing that's tapping into people's alarm about this real thing that it's reasonable to be somewhat concerned about.
Tens of millions of people in all kinds of countries believe all kinds of extreme things. There is no question. And whether or not you can affect public opinion is one thing. Another thing is to question how many of those people are terrorists and willing to be terrorists. An act of terrorism is an incredibly rare event. It is a very small number of people do it. And so there isn't actually a form of profiling as a counterterrorism strategy that's ever going to work. It's not, in addition to being un-American and against everything that we stand for, and in addition to actually being feeding into the narrative that ISIS is trying to promote about Americans, it also is ineffective because it is just too broad a scope. Even to get it down to people from a specific place and in a specific time, it's too broad a scope to find to use as a tool for counterterrorism because terrorism is too unique of an act.
Except Israeli counterterrorism experts disagree. I mean, I'm blanking on his name, but I was on with him at MSNBC, and he was talking about the fact that actually one of the reasons we all know Israel has lots of problems and challenges, but one of the reasons that their skies in terms of their planes have had fewer problems is because they actually do profile. But they don't profile in the Donald Trump way, which is to cast this bizarrely wide net on anyone who happens to be one specific religion. It's doing exactly what, you know, Rich was speaking to, which is you kind of have a checklist of specific things, whether it's ties to a specific organization, ties to a specific this, ties to a specific that, at which point it can make sense. You know, I think the progressive viewpoint is that profiling is always a dirty word. It's not. It's profiling that's stupid and ineffective should be a dirty word and should be non-existent.
And the Israelis are able to do a better job of it because they have a much smaller scale problem than people boarding their planes. So they'll do extensive interviews and really hone in on you. It's much harder for us to do that. And the Trump proposal, I mean, this is just how unworkable it is, because in Europe, you can come without a visa. You'd have the airlines having to ask at the counter what your religion is.
Right.
And then if you're a Muslim, exclude you from flying from the United States.
And that's also lie proof.
Yeah,
right.
it's completely absurd. But again, at the level of nationality, or if it was honed in more, I wouldn't have a problem with, you know, Jimmy Carter paused non-immigrant visas during the hostage crisis from Iran. We briefly, on a much smaller scale, paused the Iraqi refugee program in 2011, when it turned out we'd waved through two Iraqi terrorists and settled them in Bowling Green, Kentucky.
But what would we do during the pause? I mean, that's how Donald Trump has characterized his policy, too, that this would be a temporary ban until we can figure out what's going on. I think that's if that's not a direct quote from Trump, it's very close. But what does it mean? Like, you know, the base level problem that there are people out there in the world who would like to commit terrorist acts is not going to go away after a pause, nor are we going to find a way to identify all the people. So what would we do? Do we
know really what the process is for approving these visas? Can we think about how to tighten it up? Can we think about doing less visas in general and tightening up on tourist visas? I think we give some people like a tourist visa for a year and a half, which makes no sense. Now, some of that you don't need to pause all visas to do, but I think there are legitimate issues worth examining.
We have a pretty tight immigration system in the first instance, let's be honest. And the reality is that we're searching for an easy answer to a really complicated problem. And there is no amount of, so yes, perhaps we could come up with the perfect way to profile what a terrorist would look like coming into our nation. I have a hard time believing we can do that. And a lot of counterterror the experts believe that as well. But suppose we could do that, then what? That still is not going to deal with the larger issue of the threat of ISIS to our nation. And so we're, by focusing our attention on things that can militate against who we are as a country, on figuring out ways to make it more and more difficult for people who, be they refugees or be they people seeking economic opportunity, who can add to and make our country great and have made our country great. And so
there you go, sounding like Donald Trump. That's the most Trumpian sentiment that's been uttered on this show.
See, this is the thing, and this is the thing, and I am rarely accused of a bit of patriotism, but the idea that the Trumps of the world own patriotic sentiment is part of the problem, and that the only way to actually think about national security, if you can only be for national security if you believe in doing draconian things, that there isn't a way to, that you can't say, hey, yeah, we should fight terrorism, let's think of ways to do that doesn't undermine who we are as a nation.
I got to push back though on the idea that we have a really tight immigration system, because half of illegal immigration is visa overstays. We have at least 11 million illegal aliens that have basically zero chance of getting deported once they're in the interior of the country. So we do not have a tight immigration system.
We've deported more people than in the history of our nation in the last 8 years.
They started to do, they count people they turned around at the border as deportations when they hadn't been counted that way before. And immigration officials will tell you, if you're an illegal immigrant in the interior of the country, you're not going anywhere.
Well, the other thing is that we also have a much more open legal immigration policy than most other advanced countries. I mean, if you want to try to immigrate to Japan, you will almost certainly fail at it.
Or Australia.
Right. And so we have made the, and I think it is an explicitly American choice. And I think it's partly about the, you know, it's a broader Western hemisphere of a history of settlement, and everyone, you know, most people here have ancestors who came here from somewhere long ago. And so I think it is a unique thing. I think we beat ourselves up a lot over our immigration politics, sometimes reasonably, as with this Trump stuff that happens. But I think when we look relative to other countries, we actually have a position of relative openness.
I think it's a million and a half Muslim immigrants we've admitted since 9/11.
Is that a problem? I mean, it just goes to
Josh's point at how open we are. Now, European countries are going to trump us, and no pun intended, in terms of Muslim immigration because of the refugee crisis. But you subtract for that, and we've been one of the most generous countries to Muslims.
I just want to ask quickly, because we're almost out of time, is part of it just that people need to calm down in general about these threats? I mean, since 9/11, there have been fewer than 100 deaths on U.S. soil from extremist violence. About half of that is Islamism, half of it is other kinds of extremism. But this is like, we're talking about 6 or 7 people a year. It's a tragedy when it happens. But ultimately, this is not one of the most important threats to life that Americans face every day. And if we could just get a little more zen about that, I mean, and treat it like a normal crime type problem that we try to beat rather than an existential threat, wouldn't we be better off?
Well, I mean, listen, if it's one, it's too many. And I don't think people are crazy to be terrorized by terror, right? The whole point of it is to create terror.
Well, you could say one fatal car accident is too many.
But if we do want to put it in proportion, what they all have in common, or many of them have in common, are the firearms used in them. And we're over 400,000 deaths between 9/11 and the most recent data from firearms. So if you want to be, to take your point, if you want to be horrified about some form of violence in America, that's the one to be horrified about.
It's about the lack of control, though, Josh. You know, the whole idea is that if you are a certain kind of American, that you can kind of insulate yourself from violence, right? If you live in a certain community, if you live in a certain neighborhood, you're a certain class status. And the fact is about terror, it's the fear. What's that saying about how if you tell someone, I'm going to pinch you, that makes someone more nervous than if you just do it?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I think psychologically where a lot of Americans feel.
It's a really scary social experiment, obviously. It's terrifying.
Oh, we've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
I want to hail folks on the left who have pushed back against the idea of forbidding gun sales to people on the terror watch list, making the correct point that gun ownership in the United States is an individual constitutional right, and you only want to deny it with at least some level of due process than should be greater than what it takes to get on that mess of a list.
Kai Wright, what's your rant?
I want to hail the folks on the right who finally are acknowledging that these terror watch lists are ineffective.
Touche!
And blunt tools for a complicated problem.
Well, good, some bipartisan agreement there. Kelly Goff, what's on your mind?
I want to say the name Daniel Holtzclaw, Daniel Holtzclaw, Daniel Holtzclaw, because I want to make sure that your listeners don't forget his name. He is the police officer who was just convicted yesterday of over a dozen counts of rape and sexual assault against about a dozen African-American women who he stopped. And I think a lot of women have been overlooked in this conversation about injustice at the hands of police and communities of color. And this case should be getting more national attention. And so that's why I wanted to bring attention to it on your show.
That's all the time we have for today. I'm going to forego my rant. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Kai Wright, and Kelly Goff. Laura Dine Million produced today's program. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Hannah Tayson is our production assistant. I'm Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Whoa, so if you like pajamas, I'll wear pajamas.
You got pajamas.
For we
know we need each other, so we better call the calling of all. Let's call the whole thing off.
Download the podcast from KCRW.com or from iTunes, and share your comments at KCRW.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.